This is Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering. It's Friday, and we launch into the long weekend, reviewing a long week, mourning the loss of Marine Yohanny Rosario, a daughter of Lawrence.
A proud Dominican American, a daughter, sister, girlfriend, and auntie, a student and a teacher, a caretaker, a United States Marine.
Defending the hurried end to America's longest war.
That was the choice, the real choice, between leaving or escalating. I was not going to extend this forever war.
Returning kids to the classroom, but not in the unfettered way we had hoped.
This is the third school year that is being impacted by the COVID-19 pandemic. In preparation for a safe return to school, we have implemented a strategy that includes a mask mandate for our BPS schools.
And fighting to chart the road ahead for the state's biggest city.
You know, I believe I'm the best person to lead the city in this particular moment because I'm ready to hit the ground running and help Boston meet our challenges.
And we'll start there. Just 12 days out from the preliminary election for Boston mayor, down to the wire now. So what is your top issue in this race? And I'm curious, do you pay attention to the endorsements? Will an endorsement make a difference in how you vote? 1-800-423-8255 to join the conversation. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Let's welcome our analysts this week. Former Massachusetts Governor Jane Swift, now the President and Executive Director of Learn Launch. Governor Swift, welcome back.
Thank you for having me again.
And Gary Daffin. He is the executive director of the Multicultural AIDS Coalition and the co-chair of the Massachusetts Gay and Lesbian Political Caucus. Gary, your second time on Week in Review with us, so now I can welcome you back as well.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
It is good to have you. And Gary, I will start with you. So conventional wisdom is that people don't really pay attention to a race until after Labor Day. But Labor Day is late this year and the preliminary election 12 days from now. The latest poll came out just before the show. I don't even know the two of you happened to see it. Just out from Policy for Progress and Mass, Inc. It shows Michelle Wu with 30% support, more than double her other rivals. Here's the rundown. Janie at 15%, Asaibe George at 13%, Campbell at 11%. Barros at 4%, 19% undecided. Don't know yet the margin of error. So, Gary, what's your take on the state of the race, and what do you think is most likely to sway that remaining 19% now?
Well, I think this has been a very unusual and somewhat difficult race in the sense that so many other things have been on people's minds that it's been hard to keep this race at the forefront. And so I think there are a lot of people who are still looking at the candidates. And it will probably be a low turnout race, which usually helps the incumbent. But in this case, I think the incumbents are the people who've run citywide a couple of times. And, you know, we just don't know what will happen. It may be that the endorsement of the Globe influences folks. I don't know that endorsements have played a big role. They haven't in the past. But given that people haven't been able to pay attention because of coronavirus, because of the horrible events in Afghanistan this past week, it may be that there's going to be new attention to the race. It certainly looks like Michelle Wu is likely to be in the final, and the race is for the person to be her opponent in the runoff. And we'll just have to see what that turns out to be.
And I just want to flag for our listeners, because we're always transparent, you flagged for us before the show, Gary, that you had personally supported Andrea Campbell in this race.
Right. I haven't been involved in any campaigns, but I have personally been supporting her.
So there's more I want to dive into, Jane Swift, on this polling. So Mass Inc. says that among voters who recently cast ballots in municipal elections, and I'll get to why that's important in a second, then Anissa Asaibe George rises to second, 16%. Janie drops to third with 12%, slightly ahead of Campbell's 11%. That kind of tracks with Emerson College's poll earlier in the week, which had likely voters skewing somewhat similarly. So one, should we be paying more attention to the people most likely to vote? And what do you make of the difference of the climb for Asaibe George when you look at that population?
Well, first of all, I think it's well known that Asaibe George has a sort of very well-defined vote population, which is this sort of, she's not conservative in the sort of true sense of the word, but she's the more conservative of the candidates who are battling in this race. And as Gary said, I think this is very much a race for second at this point. I do think looking at the vote models is important. If I was Mayor Janey, Andrea Campbell, or, Councillor Asabi George, I'd actually be looking at the weather forecast because mm-hmm. that sometimes has as much to do with turnout as an endorsement by the Globe. The other thing I will be very interested in, a lot of, it's going to be such a tight race for second, yet the very people that you are in, sort of hand-to-hand combat with up until the time the polls close are the very people that a minute later you're going to have to be bringing under your tent. And so for the general election, which will also be a sprint, Massachusetts has a very late primary going into the general election.
So I got to back up for a second. How crazy, you've run and you've won. How crazy making is it that you can knock yourself out for something like an endorsement, but you can't control the weather, right? And that's the thing that might swing this thing on the day of the preliminary election.
Well, so I think the thing you can control, and I will say this as a former candidate who was the beneficiary of a big Catholic family, right? So I had a large ground game to start with, is you can control how organized you are and identifying your vote, figuring out, what those vote models look like. It was something my dad was actually really good at, knowing then how to get people to the polls, doing those calls. If it's raining, you send, this was the old traditional way, right? Like, but in a low turnout election, if it's raining, you offer people a ride.
So 800-423-8255. If you are in Boston, tell us, what are you hearing on the ground? What's the discussion you're hearing about the race? Have you heard from people who are undecided? What are they looking to know? What are the issues you're hearing about on the ground? Again, 800-423-8255 to join the conversation. So, Gary, I also want to talk about race and this race. Now, we've been talking about it all along because we have all candidates of color in this race. It will be the first time that an elected Boston mayor is not a white man. But the new poll by Policy for Progress and Mass, Inc. points something interesting out. Janey had the most support among black voters of any candidate, 23%, while white voters favored Wu, 31%, and then Asabi George, 19%. What do you make of those numbers? Does that track? Does that surprise you? And what to do with that knowledge?
It doesn't surprise me at all. I think the fact that Michelle Wu has run many times across the city and gotten votes from all different populations really helps her. She's a name that's known. The same for Asabi George. But, I think the fact that there are three black candidates in the race who are, in essence, splitting the black vote, and none of them are getting a majority of the vote, does influence the fact that, it's more difficult for them to appear in the top two candidates. But I think it's, I don't see that race has played a big part in this race, other than the discussions within the black community, and the fact that I think that the traditional, as the governor said, there's one candidate who seems to be a little bit more moderate, shall we say, not conservative. And I think that what we've been seeing across the country is that the progressive voters have not been able to necessarily, even in progressive cities like New York, pull together a coalition that overcomes what is a more moderate base overall. So I think she may be some of the neighborhoods that tend to vote more, West Roxbury, I think may be favoring her. She has the tacit endorsement, but support from the policemen and other folks. So I don't think race has been a sort of on the front line, but it is certainly in the background. And certainly I think it would be a different race if we had one black candidate rather than three.
So you heard me say oops there, because I thought for a second that your sound had dropped out there, Gary. So I want to stay at intersectionality for a second, because I want to talk about gender and race for just a minute longer in this contest. So we finished our series with the major mayoral candidates this week, speaking to John Barros Monday, and he has been fighting for mindshare, lower polling numbers, 4% in the poll that came out this afternoon. One of the things that I talked to him about was the challenge of running as a Black man in a race that seems to be presenting the moment of the woman. Here he is in response.
I am such a fan of what the women are doing, what women of color are doing, of my congresswoman, but that's not a zero-sum game. Women and women advancement and leadership doesn't mean that we can't hire or elect a Black man to be the mayor of the city of Boston. In fact, that would be revolutionary in a statement itself.
So Jane Swift, as a, you know, we've talked a lot on this show with you about the history of breaking ground as a woman in the governor's office. Huge percentage likelihood. And I'm not talking about polls. I'm just talking about four of the five candidates being women, right? So that there will be a woman as the first elected mayor of Boston. How important do you think gender is in this race?
So I actually think, ironically, gender has played a backseat role because four of the five candidates are women. I actually don't think that this race has been dominated by gender issues so much as the field is so female that it almost negates the gender issue, which is exactly what women like me have been hoping for a long time. When you have a race that all the top candidates are women, and I understand John Barrows's frustration. He probably knows, you know, how folks like me have felt for 100 years. But the truth is that I haven't heard a lot of gender issues. You know, I haven't read an article about what the candidates are wearing to the various forums. I've heard about who
came, who said what.
And that's awesome. You know, as a mother of three daughters who are watching closely, this is exactly what we want.
So Gary, the other thing that struck me in talking to all five candidates is just how front and center questions of equity are in this race. And we have long said that when you diversify a race, you diversify the lived experience in that race and new issues come to the forefront. How, you know, Jane just said what's remarkable is so many women in the race that gender isn't the issue. How remarkable is it that everybody is assuming that the underlying theme here seems to be equity?
Yeah, I think that when you look at, particularly because we've had a year where the COVID-19 pandemic underscored the fact that there are discrepancies in across ethnicities in particular, and people being more affected by the different populations being more affected by the coronavirus, you know, that was something that came to the forefront, that we wanted to talk about the changing demographics of Boston. We have seen across the country women, particularly women of color, leading major cities and making equity a major issue and looking at how cities operate and how cities contract with different businesses and what percentage of those folks are receiving, what percentage of minority businesses are receiving contracts from the city, how many women-owned companies are being supported by the city. So I think those, the fact that we have four women, all of whom know the city well and who are all talking about issues of equity, both from their personal experience, whether that's based on race or gender, has really made the race more more progressive in a way. But I'm not sure that that we will end up with the most progressive candidate as the winner in the end.
So last question on this subject for you, Jane. I've always believed that competitive elections are healthy. Candidates push each other on policy and action. That happened this week after Councillor Andrea Campbell called on Mayor Kim Janey to put in a city-based eviction moratorium. Janey did it on Tuesday. Here she is.
We had an opportunity and an obligation to make sure we are doing everything possible to keep residents in their homes during this time.
Michelle Wu had pushed free tea. Janey made a free bus line. How important is it to policy growth, to moving forward in a community, to have competitive, really contested elections?
It's everything. And I don't know if I'm going to help you transition to the next topic or not, but look at the people trying to get out of Afghanistan to come here. As flawed as our system is, it's still the best one that exists, and it works best when lots of people from lots of different backgrounds raise ideas that people care about. And you just gave a lot of examples. Not everybody will agree on what the action was that was taken, but that's how democracy works best.
Yeah, we will be talking about that. We're actually going to do that in the last section of the show, but I'm glad you previewed it. I also want to point out WBUR and Radio Boston are going to join WCVB, the Boston Globe, and the McCormick School at UMass Boston to bring you a debate. That is going to be next Thursday, September 9th. And next week, listeners, we will give you more information about that debate. It's why we did the series of conversations with the candidates leading up to it, the major candidates over this last month. Okay. With us this week, Gary Daffin, the executive director of the Multicultural AIDS Coalition and former Massachusetts Governor Jane Swift, and you. So join us. We're going to talk now about the start of the school year, which is the third impacted by a pandemic and a return to offices, all as Delta rises. Are you ready? Are your kids ready, or are they there already? What is on your mind as we continue to mass to push for more vaccinations? Job reports out. It's not great. Are we turning a corner, or do you feel like we're headed in the wrong direction? I also wonder, are those out there feeling like some way we just have to find a way to get back to the business of living? 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK to join the conversation. So, Jane Swift, we are in the thick of it again. Highest single-day increase in cases since April on Wednesday. That's 1,796 cases. Breakthrough cases grew. Now one-third of all hospitalizations, although I want to point out that is still far less than 1% of COVID cases. Schools started to open this week. You work in education with Learn Launch. So question number one, does Delta loom large? Is it right now the organizing framework for our lives, the way the pandemic has been at some points in the past?
So I think that just depends in what industry you're in. But yes, certainly if you're working in education, we unfortunately do not yet have an approved vaccine for younger children. If you're a parent of those younger children, this is a huge issue. Also, if you live in an area, I don't know if you saw the article, but the Bay State Health System has its highest hospitalization rate. That's out in Western Mass in Hampden County. They now have higher numbers of folks in the ICU than they had at the last peak. And they unfortunately have the lowest vaccination rate of many counties in Massachusetts. So there are very significant issues, but there are very well-known ways to protect our children, to protect our teachers, and to try, as you said, to make this school year as normal as possible, but it will not be a normal school year. I posted earlier on Twitter, you know, CDC guidance for parents. It would be awesome if everybody would just follow the science. Maybe that's a pipe dream.
So many things I want to pick up on there. I'm going to start, Gary, with a little bit of sound from Dr. Benjamin Linus of Boston Medical Center. So he was on Ask the Doctors this week. I talked to him about Delta. He pointed out that his kids started school this week, and he says that it is a good thing for them to be back in person, even with Delta.
We are not in the same place that we were this time last year. And I know there's a lot of anxiety around Delta, but Delta does not take us back to the very beginning. We know that we can mitigate this disease. And with people being vaccinated, I think it's absolutely a year to send our kids to school. And this year, our model should effectively be a normal year of school. And we're going to hang as much mitigation as we possibly can around that.
So what strikes me is that balance, Gary, the normal year of school and as much mitigation, which by definition means not normal, based on what normal right. used to be. For example, masks on kids, masks on everybody, according to the state. So I guess the organizing framework for school needs to be keep kids in the buildings, even if it creates needs for these mitigation measures all year.
Yeah, I think everyone believes that it's good for kids to be in school, to have the social interaction with friends and learn better. But I think what we see is this fighting among adults, more so than the children and the young people, about those mitigation factors. You know, I was home and a couple weeks ago, my six-year-old nephew was sitting watching television at my mother's house in his mask, perfectly happy, because he knew he was helping to protect Granny. But we have these bizarre fights about, you know, the rights people have to wear a mask or not, that the kids don't seem to be wanting to get into. They want to be safe. And so, yeah, it's normal now is to wear a mask inside. And I think where the country in general continues to be a little bit confused, because we keep getting information about the Delta variant, about, you know, vaccinated people becoming infected. Can they pass on the infection? Can they not? So we're still in a state of people not being completely sure about what to think. But the best advice, as the doctor said, is to keep the mitigation strategies going until we know more, and we find out more about how, you know, whether we've peaked with Delta, whether we need to have boosters. There's just so much information that we still don't have, and that I think that is confusing people to some extent. But in terms of school, I think we, you know, and the governor would have more expertise on this, but I think we continue to implement the mitigation strategies that we have to the best that we can, and try to have as normal, it won't be normal, but as normal a school year as we can.
1-800-423-8255 to join the conversation. We've got Liz on the line. Liz is calling from her car somewhere in the Commonwealth, right, Liz?
Yes, I'm up on the North Shore.
Go ahead.
So I have been on the front lines for this whole thing. And I work in an urgent care office, and today was my last day working on the front lines. I actually switched within the company so I could work from home. I'm very nervous about what's coming up. The Delta variant is very scary, and we're seeing a lot of breakthroughs. And I just wanted to sort of chime in because I heard you ask, you know, is there normal coming up? And I kind of feel like there isn't. And I just wanted to chime in.
You wanted to say, hey, no, it doesn't feel like there's normal coming up. Thank you for that call, Liz. So here's what that makes me think, Jane. We hear Gary talking about kids, you know, getting used to masks. I hear Liz's fear, right? And what I think about is we want kids. What one thing that we do want to be normal is a lack of fear. How do, and yet our kids under the age of 12, can't get vaccinated. The governor, in fact, let me play a little sound here. This is Governor Baker this week in East Hampton responding about guidance from the Board of Early Education and Care for masks for little ones.
For the 16 to 19-year-olds, I think we're almost 20 points ahead of the national average. And for the 12 to 15-year-olds, we're probably about 15 to 18 points ahead of the national average. The safest thing we can do is to make sure that everybody who's eligible gets vaccinated. So I hope people take that seriously.
So I had said that was the one I wanted, and then I went with another one. So poor people in the control room gave us the wrong cut. Here's the one I did actually want now.
The youngest kids at this point in time aren't able to get vaccinated. We fully expect that at some point this fall, the rules with respect to that will change. And we'll work really hard at that point in time to help those that want to get vaccinated get vaccinated. But I think they're viewing that at this point in time as an appropriate measure as, you know, school starts and as people start incorporating more of those early ed programs into their daily lives. And I think it makes sense.
So you want people to follow the science. We are with our older kids, but our younger kids can't. We don't want kids to be afraid. How do we message this so that kids can live and learn without anxiety?
So anxiety is up. There are some great social emotional learning programs out there, and wisely many schools and early childhood programs are implementing those and leading with those this fall, and I applaud that. I've always been sort of a hard bar on academics, but if kids don't feel safe, they can't learn. What protects the youngest kids, and I have told you and your listeners on a number of occasions that my husband is at very high risk. He actually was in the first group to get a third shot. And so I live this life, right? And I have three daughters who are all returning to campus. One of them called me and sent me a picture last week of how close the desks were at the campus that she's in. And that just makes her so afraid, right, for what she might bring back to her father. So I live this. I understand it as a mom. What I know our doctors have said is all of us being vaccinated, all of us wearing masks protect those who are at risk. So as the governor said in your first clip, if the adults are all vaccinated. If everyone wears a mask, we protect those who are either the vaccine is not as effective or they cannot be vaccinated. The reason that there are a lot more people in ICU in Hamden County than there are in Essex County, which is where that woman called from, is because, yes, you can get breakthrough cases, and we don't, as Gary said, you know, the numbers are still coming through. But what is very clear is that people get far less sick and breakthrough cases if they've been vaccinated, and it does not spread as quickly in a vaccinated population, which protects all of us. So I think if we follow what doctors and scientists say and stop, you know, that is the best way. But I believe me, I understand. Every time somebody doesn't wear a mask, one of my daughters calls me.
So Gary, Jane, I'm stopping for a second just because I'm just thinking about the anxiety for your daughters, thinking about your husband. I mean, that makes it very real. So, Gary, we are now down to masks on and shots in arms, which has been the conversation for as long as shots have been available to go into arms, and masks have been a conversation for even longer. And this week we have some new conversation again about misinformation, confusion, mixed messaging, lack of willingness to get vaccines. I want to start with a caller we got from Franklin in Ask the Doctors on Wednesday. Here's Allison.
What changed from the public being told for months and months to wear a mask to protect others? But then that changed, and now we are told to wear a mask to protect others, but also to protect ourselves. What changed?
And I do remember vividly early in the pandemic, Gary, the mask was, you don't wear a mask for yourself. You wear a mask for your community. One way to interpret Allison's call is, did that not work? And so we got to appeal to self-interest. Another way to interpret it is, the messaging keeps changing. What do I trust? Well, our understanding changes, and then our messaging changes because our policies change. But that does create uncertainty. How do we deal with that?
Yeah, I think one of the big differences about this is that people are paying attention to science. And we're trying to give people information faster than we normally would. You know, having worked in HIV, we would do studies, but the general public wouldn't hear about them until they were, you know, years along and we had more definitive information. What's happening now is that we're trying to get as much information as we can and look at data from trials or just experience and make recommendations. And those things just keep changing because the virus changed and what we know changed. Inevitably, people are going to be confused. I do think we need to perhaps try to make the messaging simpler and perhaps not have as much going out as quickly as we have because it inevitably has made for confusion as the message gets changed. But I think we have to be clear with the general public that information is going to change as we learn more. And there's no way to prevent that. But the basic messages of let's have mitigation strategies that we know do work. I mean, we know that the mask helps. The particulars of it we can get into, but the main thing is being vaccinated and wearing a mask are two things that will help us in this pandemic. And I think we perhaps need to think about having less detailed information and clearer information to people about what we absolutely know. The example, the booster shot, for example, that has become a bit of a mess because too much information went out first before we had all the data, and now the White House is changing its strategy. So I think we need to just perhaps go a little bit slower in terms of putting out so much information in the general public when we don't have as good a basis as we would like.
So listeners, so let me put that question then, Gary, to our listeners. Gary is making a TMI. argument that actually sometimes we have too much information flowing before we know what we really know and we know what to do with it. Has that been your experience during this pandemic? Do you agree that sometimes too much information is just plain too much? 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK to join the conversation. Gary, I want to pivot over to Jane here because I want to bring one more piece of this in, which is around misinformation. Jane Swift, one of the more remarkable moments for me in covering this pandemic was reading this tweet from the FDA to Dr. Ashish Jha earlier this week. Quote, "You are not a horse. You are not a cow. Seriously, y'all, stop it," end quote. That is a tweet from the FDA. And it refers, of course, to the trend of people ingesting ivermectin in the form of a livestock dewormer to either try to prevent or cure COVID. I am mindful that the Center for Countering Digital Hate identified a disinformation dozen back in May, 12 people or sources who produced 65% of the shares of vaccine misinformation on social media. So we're ingesting horse tranquilizer. We distrust vaccines. 12 sources are trafficking 65% of that. It feels like we ought to be able to have some cause and effect there. And yet, here we are. You are not a horse. You are not a cow.
So I live on a farm, as you know. We used to have horses. Now we have cows. But I have seen ivermectin.
Perfect.
And there is such a temptation to just let people who are that dumb take the ivermectin. But it unfortunately, there are people who, because they see things in a certain context and see it repeated, particularly older people who, you know, may be afraid, right? So people prey on fear. It's kind of like those terrible people who call elderly people after they've had a loss and scare them into thinking their grandchildren are in jail. And I would just say that that's why I put up the CDC information, and it's simple, it's FAQs. You know, the governor, for all you may agree or disagree with him politically, he has been consistently out there and in the public. And so there are consistent forms of good information. And I will also, I have a daughter, and I've talked about this publicly before, who has juvenile arthritis. And she takes, for juvenile arthritis for the last 10 years, hydroxychloroquine. Mm-hmm. The steps she has had to go through for the last 5 months to get her hydroxychloroquine now filled, because there was this other run on, you know, people who thought that was some magic formula, are unbelievable and expensive. And so actually, in some cases, real people get hurt because the thing that you need those things for, now I'm not overly worried about horses, but, you know, it just, we need to stop.
I appreciate that. And so reiterating, do not take large animal dewormer in place of a vaccine for COVID-19. I am going to also flag.
Unless you're a horse.
Right. I am going to flag that Business Insider reported that the National Institutes of Health is studying the active ingredient in ivermectin for its impact. So I guess it raises a question. And when we get that information, we will then know what to do about that. Gary, so now, okay, back full circle to shots in arms. How do we drive up the number? We know we need to drive up the number.
Yeah, I think we have to get some of the people who have, particularly people in leadership who have not sufficiently promoted vaccination. We're seeing a little bit of this in some places. We need to get them to be unequivocal about the fact that getting vaccinated is the best way to protect yourself and your community from the coronavirus. We need to make it possible for people to get vaccinated in as many places as possible. I mean, our experience, we have a vaccine clinic at my shop. Our experience is that we go out and literally find people on the street and say, have you been vaccinated yet? And if they haven't and they have the opportunity at that moment, they will come. If they're being recruited by someone that they know and trust. And whether that's in Roxbury or whether it's in Des Moines, Iowa, the fact that people will listen to people that they trust is the most important thing for us to do to get people to put shots in their arm, to get a shot in the arm, because there's so much misinformation, so many conspiracy theories, some of it intentional, some of it just stupid. But people will listen to folks that they believe. And there's some folks who are just never going to get the shot. There's a segment of the community that just won't. But for most people, they can be persuaded, and they're going to be persuaded by information from folks that they know and trust. And I think that's, in bottom line, the only way we're going to get this to the point where a large enough proportion of the country has been vaccinated.
I'm Tiziana Deering, and with us this hour, Gary Daffin, Executive Director of the Multicultural AIDS Coalition and former Massachusetts Governor Jane Swift. And reflect with us, because now we are going to talk about a messy, deadly end to America's longest war this week, including the death of one local Marine, Yohani Rosario, a daughter of Lawrence. This as we approach the two-decade anniversary of the event that brought us here in the first place, 9/11. So call us. Where are you this week in thinking about the war's legacy and the 9/11 legacy? 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. All of this conversation has deep roots here in Massachusetts. The 9/11 attacks included planes that left from Logan Airport with locals on board. So listen, next week we won't have a week in review on September 10th because we're going to bring listeners a special hour commemorating the 20th anniversary of 9/11. And Governor Swift, you were governor on that day and for the launch of the war in Afghanistan. So I want to, in a minute, reflect with you specifically. Before I do that, though, Gary, let me just turn to you and ask you, what did you feel seeing President Biden address the end of the war on Tuesday?
For me, it really made me think about the bigger picture and sort of, well, I thought about these soldiers who had died, and I kept thinking about how few of us in the country now have the experience of serving in the military or having family who serve in the military. And so that war is something very distant. And I think over the past 20 years, we haven't paid enough attention to it. And I agree with the president's decision to get out. Of course, it was messy. I think it would have been messy and horrible in any way. But what was most striking to me is the fact that we haven't as a country really dealt with or considered what war really means for a long time. It's something that we watch on television. And I felt obviously great sadness for the families that had lost soldiers and the people in Afghanistan who lost family members. But I think we as a country have to really think about what does war mean to us now and what does it mean to go to war and what does sacrifice mean?
Governor Swift, I'm going to turn to you. We've got a caller I want to grab, and then I will do that. We've got 800-423-8255. We've got Tom on the line in Needham. Tom, go ahead. Tom? So we don't have good sound from Tom. If we can get him back and get that sound, we will. So, Gary, sit tight. I'm going to turn to Governor Swift for a couple of minutes here because you sat in one of only 50 seats, Governor Swift, on 9/11, which is the governor's seat. We are now at the end of the war, a war that was triggered by those events, a painful, complex chapter of American history, definitely not the end of the story. How are you reflecting on the end of the Afghan war this week?
So I think it's really interesting how we decide to categorize this as the longest war when we hadn't really had a huge number of casualties in Afghanistan for a very long time. We had a very small force, smaller than what we have in Korea, in Germany, both of which were wars that, you know, were much longer ago, and we don't call that an ongoing war, even though we still have a physical presence. And so I think the political semantics, which continued to call this a war, is what created the overwhelming public sentiment that we should get out. I didn't share that sentiment. I thought we had stabilized that country. We had a very small force. We were not taking enormous casualties. I agree with Gary. We send a very small percentage of Americans to fight. But frankly, the way that we pulled out put many of them in jeopardy, and I believe over the long term will complicate the role of our permanent military in the Middle East. But I also am a very firm believer that establishing a flawed, for sure, democracy, but stabilizing a country that was educating women, that had a more open society where girls were getting an education, was preferable to having a terrorist organization that we now apparently feel we have to deal with in charge.
So I want to stay with you for just a minute longer. We've already started some interviews in preparation for our 9/11 show next week. And I am telling you, it's hard. I'm stunned at how vividly that day comes back. It sits in my head and my heart like it happened yesterday. Where were you when you found out about the attacks that day? And how present is that moment for you now?
So I can remember, so as you know, I had small, very young children on those days. And like many mothers, frantic mothers with three children under the age of four, I don't remember every minute of every day. They were busy days. I remember every minute of that day, just about. And I do think, and I'm honored that the families of 9/11 have asked me to speak at the ceremony they're having next Saturday. It takes my breath away that I was able or called upon to be their governor, and that I worked with them then, and that they would have me come back now. I guess the one thing I would like everyone to focus on as we head into 9/11, and this will be the focus of my remarks, so I could tell you how I felt and what I was called on to do. My daughters, who are now juniors in college, were babies that morning. And my oldest, who's, you know, in her last semester of college, was a toddler. There were babies at home whose moms got on that plane. There were unborn children whose fathers and mothers got on that plane. So many families who lost so many people. And yet, over the intervening 20 years, families in Massachusetts have exhibited such grace, such courage, and have created so much goodness in the world and giving back that, with, as we just talked about, right, this terrible COVID crisis that has been unequal and unfair and how it's impacted our community. I think there are some real lessons to be learned about how, really, in the face of unimaginable tragedy, they found a way to give back and to try to make our country. Many of them gave back to Afghanistan in an unbelievably generous way. So that's what I hope we'll focus on, because I think there are some lessons. And certainly it's their loss and then their courage moving forward that I think should be honored the most, just as the young woman who lost her life as a Marine in Lawrence deserves our focus this week.
Thank you for that reflection. I'm not going to do hubbubs. I'm going to end with calls. But before we do that, Gary, coming back to you briefly, what do you want to see from your country next?
Well, that's a big question. I would mostly, with respect to Afghanistan, like to see us do as much as possible to bring the folks who helped us and supported us throughout the past 20 years get out of that country if they are in danger. I think we need to really think through what our presence in Afghanistan was for, what was the purpose. And there are obviously things that we needed to do and accomplish from the beginning, whether that purpose was sustained throughout the 20 years. We need to think through how are we going to be engaged in countries where the cultures are not like ours, and that we're not going to be able to inspire the kind of democracy that we have. So I just think we need to think through, as I said earlier, like, what does war mean to us? What is our ongoing role in the world as peacekeepers, as supporting different countries and their development. And, you know, what sacrifices are we asking of our people, and make sure that the purpose and is there, and that we understand what the goals are.
Let's take a couple calls now. We've got Denise on the line in Brookline. Denise, go ahead.
Hi, can you hear me okay?
Yes.
Okay, excellent. Thank you for taking my call. My comment is this. My husband was in the infantry for 15 years, and he received a Purple Heart, which is a career-ending injury as a result of his time spent in the war in the infantry in Afghanistan. My comment is simple. 20 years is too long. What are we as a country doing at war for 20 years in the modern era? It's that simple. Like, politics aside, human life aside, we should expect better from ourselves. We just cannot go and occupy other countries and fight for two decades and expect there to be like a tidy ending. And that's just my comment. Thank you very much. I'll take any feedback offline.
Denise, thank you. And thank you for your husband's sacrifice and your shared sacrifice with him. I think we can take another one. I think we're going to try Tom again. Tom in Needham, do we have you this time?
Hi, Tiziana. Can you hear me okay?
Now I can. Go ahead.
Excellent. Sorry about that. The Bluetooth is a tricky thing. So I'm glad I went after after that caller, Denise. You know, I'm about to turn 25. This war has been going on practically my entire life, and I couldn't agree more. 20 years is far too long, you know, and I feel like President Biden has gotten far too much flack than he deserves for ending the war. I am so grateful that the war is over, because a woman my age from two towns over from where I grew up just died for something that started when she was a child, when she was in elementary school. And I'm glad it's over. I don't think the United States, quite frankly, has the moral authority anymore to be the world's police in certain instances where we have plenty of problems for ourselves to deal with. And it's not fair for these servicemen and women who served so valiantly and so bravely to stay over there to fight a losing war.
Tom, thank you for that call. And I appreciated ending on Caller Voices. I want to note to everybody, again, next Friday, September 10th, rather than a week in review, we will do a special 20th anniversary show reflecting on the day of 9/11. And you'll hear coverage all week from WBUR next week on that. What a thoughtful set of conversations, especially at the end there. Former Massachusetts Governor Jane Swift, now the president and executive director of Learn Launch. Governor Swift, thank you.
Thank you for having me again.
And Gary Daffin, he is the executive director of the Multicultural AIDS Coalition and the co-chair of the Massachusetts Gay and Lesbian Political Caucus. Gary, really appreciate it. Thanks.
Great to be here. Thanks.